Hello, everybody. My name's Larry Thomas, and I'm an alcoholic. And I'm glad to be here, and I'd like to thank everybody who's involved in this get-together for having me up here, me and Gloria up here. I've enjoyed myself tremendously. And we've had some of the best AA you can find in California. I'm the last chapter of the Long Beach version of AA, I guess, you know. And you've had some excellent examples of Alcoholics Anonymous, you know. And we were eating some of the stuff that was in our motel room last night. They gave us a fruit basket and some bananas and stuff. And as of this morning, I have all the respect in the world for figs. It won't be a long talk, but it'll be a tightly run one, I'm sure. I was kind of apprehensive about coming up here because, you know, I wasn't sure. I thought, you know, I mean, to be honest, for the past 2 weeks, I thought it was a gay convention. Yeah. No, I mean, that's not good or bad or something like that, but people have been asking me downtown, you know, is it the gay convention? I don't know. You know, I really don't know. I'd never thought about it one way or the other. And then I'm in the food line yesterday, and a 6'8" man, there he is right there. He says, excuse me, Peaches, I want to lay down some chicken. And I said, well, I said, that answers this, you know. So, frightened the hell out of me. And I haven't been hugging a lot of people up here this weekend. And I'm sure you're all glad of that. It's good to be in a meeting. And if you're new, I've been sober for 11 years, and I owe that to not drinking. This is about as deep as it's going to get today, so, you know, we'll take it from there. But I've been happy about that most of the time. I have been happy about that fact most of the time. And I owe that to Alcoholics Anonymous and only Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, that'll probably throw you for a loop right there, because those two words don't belong in the same sentence. Happy and being sober. I have never been happy about that idea. The idea of me being sober never brought on a, yeah, all right, this is it. That they don't belong in the same room together. Alcoholics of my type drank because of the way they felt when they were sober. The way that I felt when I was sober drove me to drink time and time and time and time again. And the idea of not drinking never seemed as a neat idea, you know. And if you're new, I beg you, you know, I'm living proof you can stay sober for 11 years and not amount to a goddamn thing. You know, I tell you, my sponsor tells me I'm not much, but I'm all I think about. And I just can't seem to prove them wrong. Down there where I'm from, we have a book study every Wednesday. And there was a paragraph that always rings true to me. It says, and I'm sure you're all familiar with it. It says, we know that while the alcoholic keeps away from drink, as he may do for days, months, or years, he begins to react much like other men. Now, just how do we react like other men? Well, I'm sure that once that normal guy stops drinking, there's no doubt in his mind that he can drink again. And me neither. And that's been my problem. That's the only way I react like a normal guy, is after I get sober, it's just a matter of days or months that the idea comes back that I can drink again. I've never been able to hold on. A bad memory, a bad drunk has never been able to keep me sober. The memory of my last hideous drunk has never been enough. I've never been able to come up with enough sound reasoning not to drink, because everything in me tells me I should drink. Every fiber in me says, head on, you know. And if you're new, I urge you to swim in crowded beaches. I urge you to swim in crowded beaches. Because when you come to Alcoholics Anonymous, what your tendency is going to be after you're here for a while is, I can do it by myself. And that hideous complacency, the cancer of AA, will start taking over. And if you're new, learn to swim in crowded beaches. Because in moments of desperation, you'll have people around you who are doing things that you can't find yourself able to do, and you're talking yourself out of doing that day. and they will pull you along. And there'll be some days when your buddy won't be able to make it and you'll be able to pull him along. Because I talked to you from experience, because at 5 years sober I was in that fork in the road. And I'd been learning to swim in those crowded beaches. And I found myself out there in the riptides of complacency. And on the shore to the new people around me, it looked like I was doing all right because my hands were moving. And the only thing you don't see in a drowning man at sea is his feet tiring out. And my sponsor would come by and throw me a lifesaver. And I'd throw it back at him and say, I know what I'm doing. I don't need your help. In the back of my mind, I'll know what to do if I want to drink. In the back of my mind. Now that's a hell of a place for anything of value to be for me, is in the back of my mind. Because you wouldn't believe what's in front of it. I mean, you talk about an obstacle course, you know. And Alcoholics Anonymous has been able to keep, my primary purpose is to stay sober and to carry the message to the alcoholic who suffers. Whether he took dope, whether he's throwing up and eating, whether he's gambling, means nothing to me. But if that fellow be an alcoholic, that's my primary purpose, is right up front. And you've taught me to keep that up front. No matter what's going on around me, what's going on with me or with people, my primary purpose is to stay sober and carry this message to the alcoholic who suffers. And you taught me that. You know, because every therapy that's ever been applied to me, everything, for years they've been trying to work on me from the head down. They'll work on your emotions. They'll work on your mentality. They'll work on everything from the head down. And if you're new in Alcoholics Anonymous, it's a whole reverse process. Because what they'll do is they'll treat your feet. Alcoholics Anonymous has trained my feet. So that while I'm home thinking I'm not going to go to that meeting, she's going to be there, he's talking, I'm going down to the meeting and say, hi, my name's Larry, I'm an alcoholic. Everything about Alcoholics Anonymous has gone against my will. Everything about Alcoholics Anonymous goes against my will. It's the longest thing I've ever done against my will. Which is why it works so damn good. Which is why it works so good. You have a disease, you have a lethal, deadly, deadly disease. And when I think of lethal diseases, I think of AIDS, and I think of cancer, and I think of heart, and I think of all these solutions to these diseases that have hoses and people in coats and high-tech hospitals and just busy solutions and hospitals and stuff like that. You also have a lethal disease. This does not look like the answer to a lethal disease. This does not look like the answer. A camp out? Come on now. This is going to keep, you know what I'm saying? Walking up these damn high, you know, this does not look like the answer to a lethal disease. And if you're new, it's not. This is not the answer to your disease. This is a small part of the pie. This is a small portion. Because there's a big secret that people are trying to keep from newcomers these days, and it's called the 12 Steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. And if you don't apply, I hate to burst your bubble this weekend, but if you don't apply these steps to your life, you can camp till you're blue. There ain't a camp out in the world that's going to keep you sober. This is a small part of the deal of a way of life called Alcoholics Anonymous, because you're going to need something that they call, that science hasn't been able to remedy, medicine hasn't been able to remedy, and it's called a spiritual experience. Is going to remove that obsession, and it's only gotten by the applications of these principles. I'm sorry. You know, but that's the way it is. And that's what I love about Alcoholics Anonymous, man. I love Alcoholics Anonymous. I love the way I feel today when I'm with you. You know, and just to give you an idea, what just a goofy man you have up here, and how self-obsessed we can get. About 5 years sober, I'm working at a construction site downtown Los Angeles, and we're going to demo this old hotel down at 50th and North Central, called the old Dunbar Hotel. And we're going to demo it because, you know, they're going to turn it into a seniors home. And there have been some gangbanging going down there, and some guys got shot and stuff like that, so the construction foreman got together with the security guard, and he says, let's get these guys in here early so we can get them out in the evening earlier. Get them out of here by 3, man. So that Monday, I show up at the construction site. I got my tool belt on, and it's pitch dark out. I get into this elevator, and these two guys are in behind me, and the elevator closes, and the guy says, hit the floor. I said, oh, shit. I get down on this elevator floor and I'm just starting to shake. I'm starting to think about my first sponsor who says what goes around comes around. You know? There's a little bit of hope for you, you know? And I start thinking about that $3 that I got in my pocket, and I'm the cookie lady, and if they take that, you know, I'm gonna, you know, and all this hideous stuff is going through my mind, you know. There's old Kev. And I'm thinking if he touches me, you know, I'm gonna nail him with my wrench, and just all kinds of crap going on in my head, you know, that out the imagination, you know. And all of a sudden the elevator stops. These doors open up, and these two guys walk right by me. I says, what the hell is that all about, man? Come time for lunch, I go to the Roach Coach. I'm going to give the guy some dough, and I'm getting some coffee and stuff like that, and I go to give him my money. He says, you don't got to pay for that. I said, what? He says, you don't got to pay for that. He says, you see those two guys back there? I said, yeah. He says, they never laughed so hard in their whole damn life. He says, they worked for the elevator company. When you got in, they were testing the floor. They were testing the cables, and they wanted you to hit the floor button. I said, no shit. For Christ's sake, man. You know, if there's anything that pisses an alky off, it's public humiliation, you know. I mean, you know, and I don't need any help. I don't need any help. Boy, I tell you, man, every morning after that, I was right there, man. Where do you want to go? You know, I just public humiliation, and I've always done, my book tells me in my best moments, I produce confusion. Okay? When I'm peaking, when I'm heavily involved, and I got guys in the car, and everything's going right, you can bet your bottom dollar that there's going to be some shit going on in a matter of minutes, man. I mean, it's just the way I am. And Alcoholics Anonymous hasn't done a lot for my mind and stuff like that, but what it does, it's trained my feet so that I'm with you. So that I'm with you, because my mind tells me I can do it by myself, you know. And I welcome you to Alcoholics Anonymous, man. And my mom and dad aren't the reason why I come to AA. They're not the blamers in my life. I had a great mom and dad. I had some fine folks. My mom was a little Scandinavian lady, man. If there ever was such a thing. And she loved speed. She loved those diet pills, man. My mom loved that speed, you know. And I caught on at an early age that if I ever wanted any love or affection, I could find my mom around 4 a.m. sorting out nuts and bolts all damn night, you know. Be out there in the garage all hours of the night, you know, or, you know, raking up the neighbor's yard around 5 a.m, you know. And Jesus Christ, you know. And she had a thing for needlepoint. She loved the needlepoint, you know. She'd be needling and clicking and clacking all damn night, you know, and, you know, knitting covers for everything. Toilet paper had covers, you know. Bottles had covers. Everything had, I had mittens and booties I didn't know what the hell to do with, you know. I'd throw them away and she thought I needed a new pair, you know. She'd knit these damn afghans that could drape this room, you know, and the weirdest colors, you know, the yellows and the pinks and the blues, and just a wild lady, you know. And and she was always out in the garage. She had an aversion for that garage. That was her little workshop, you know. And she used to take my dad's nails and nuts and bolts and screws and put them in little Gerber baby jars, and then put the lid on a piece of wood so he can twirl them around and find them, you know. And son of a bitch never spent a day out in the garage for long as I knew him, man. And he knew who was out there, you know. He knew who was out there. No way, man. You don't want to be around people like that. I mean, they could see your blackheads from here. Hey, man, you know, and they'll come after you, you know. And she'd be up all night packing lunches, man. You could hear her with that wax paper, you know, and you'd see her at 5 a.m, hear it, you know, and you go, whoa, you know. And she loved to serve me burnt food. She was always overcooking shit. There was, chili burnt, everything burnt, and toast was burnt. And she would always tell me, you know, it's okay, you know, burnt food's good for your gums, you know. She ain't got a tooth in her head, okay? She ain't got a tooth in there, and she's telling me it's good for her gums, you know what I mean? And that's the kind of message I got from her, okay? But she loved me well. She loved me well. She was a good mom, man. I mean, I love my mom. And my dad was a refinery worker, and my dad loved to drink. He found happiness drinking. He found violence sober, but he loved to drink. He was an angry man, but he loved to drink. And he was a refinery worker, so sometimes he was working days, and sometimes he was working nights, and sometimes he's working graveyards, you know. But Dad was a window climber. The old man was a window climber. He was either sneaking in or sneaking out of his own damn house. It was amazing, you know. And And that I could tell because I could feel his greasy boot on my chest as he's coming in and out of the damn window, you know. And he snuck in there one night, and I was just fed up. I said, for Christ's sake, Dad, why don't you have Mom make you a set of keys, man? You know, she's up anyway. You know, she's out there right now probably, you know. She could probably knit you a key ring to go with it, you know. And make the damn key with her teeth, you know. And but just get the hell off my chest, you know. And he would bring in all kinds of guys with them, man. There'd be two or three guys coming through this damn window. And it's hard to have respect for your old man when he doesn't have keys to his own home, you know. That's odd. And then I got out of that room, and then I started sleeping with my grandfather. And he told me, he said, you know, you look better than both of your sisters. And I'll make you feel like a champ. You know, you know, and so I'm sleeping in there with Gramps, and Gramps was a rosary reader, you know, and I could hear it, you know, midnight, you'd hear the psh, 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 and then click around a couple beads, and then psh, 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 click around a couple more beads, you know, and then there'd be deadly silence. And then he'd walk over to his little sock drawer, pull out the sock drawer, and you hear this, take a shot of that peach bandy, and you hear this, ah, he'd come back over the bed, you know, and psh, 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 and then it'd be silence. And then you'd hear this. And the old man was sanding his bunions down, you know. And I'm going, shit, where does the kid get some sleep around here, you know? I mean, Mom's up all night mowing the neighbor's yard. Dad's stuck in a window. And Grandpa's rubbing himself raw all damn night, you know. I'm dying for some sleep. So I go out to the living room and I start sleeping on the couch. And me and Cal Worthington start hooking up at an early age, you know. And that's when I start getting curious. I start looking in the medicine chest, and I start taking shit in the medicine chest. I start sniffing that Mexican cocaine. We called it glue. The old man come home from graveyards. I got the PT-109 just all over me, man, you know. And just wild to get out that rug cleaner, you know. And I got into my old man's thermos, tried some of that old port wine and stuff like that. And around 9 years old. And you know what? You know, up until around 9 or 10 years old, I'm a happy kid, man. I've got buddies and I've got little girlfriends and I'm a happy kid. Life's okay, you know. Life as a child is great so far, you know. But around 9 or 10 years old, I don't know. The things that other kids seem to be getting out of everyday living, I'm coming home empty. I'm playing the same football, at the same baseball, going to the same school. And man, they seem to be getting, life seems to be easy and enough for them. And life has never been enough for me. As it is by itself. There's always been something missing, man. And I knew there was something missing, and I've always been looking for an answer. I grew up, I started looking for an answer, man. And around 12 years old, I was around 9 years old, my dad come into that bedroom of mine. And he says, you're going to have a baby brother. Oh, man, that alky imagination kicked in. I start oiling up my glove, man, thinking about that kid brother. Start saving my baseball cards. Start thinking about how me and him are going to play football and how we're going to play baseball and how we're going to go to the drag strip and stuff like that and beat up my two sisters, you know, and stuff like that. And 9 months later, my dad comes into that same bedroom and he says, your baby brother died. I don't remember having any compassion for my mom. I don't remember having any kind of thoughts like, you know, how's she doing, how's she feeling, is there anything I can do? I don't remember asking my dad, you know, how's she feeling or anything like that. I did something that was going to follow me to this day. Something that was going to follow me to this day, and that is we go right through temper tantrum into rage in a New York second. And I remember flying at the old man. And I'm going to cross one of many invisible lines in my life. Because I don't know about anybody else in here, but there's an invisible line when a young man attacks his father for the first time. You cross a strange ground there now. You violated something there and you know it. Because you're after your old man now. That man you used to respect and love and something like that is gone. When a moment of rage and I went after my old man and I crossed that invisible line. And the only thing I remember is I'm trying to smack my old man is yelling at him, you promised me. You promised me. You promised me a baby brother. You lied to me. And from that point on, that put a brick in a wall that I'd been slowly building as a kid that's going to separate me and my mom and me and my dad for a long time. If there was anything I could hate with my old man, I couldn't stand the ground he walked on. Everything about my old man, I just hated everything about him. Because he's just a mirror image of me, and I knew it. Every time I would get angry, I'd see his face. Every time I'd yell at a woman, I'd see my mom's face. And I just didn't know what to do. And I felt guilty about that. God, I felt guilty about that. Because I'd look down that street and I'd see guys going to the Dodger game with their dads. And I'm going, why can't I have that? why am I hating my old man? I start feeling guilty about that. All of a sudden, man, I tell you, if there's anything that's ever plagued me my whole life, man, is I've been able to beat myself unmiserably all the time. I've never been worthy enough. That lack of confidence, lack of self-worth, always doubting, inadequate. Why am I here? Why aren't I enough? Everybody seems to be flourishing and they're solid and they're just strong in their way of thinking, and I seem so flaky, you know? And you try to hide that your whole life with different things. And at the age of 12 years old, there's four of us in a garage across the street, and I took my shot of Coors whiskey for the first time in my life. I felt like you looked. For the first time in my life, I took a shot of that whiskey, and it went down, and it warmed me up, and it made me feel like, yes, this is what these people are getting with football and school. This is how I'm supposed to be feeling. And then I puked, you know. But I never forgot. You see, because these are the three guys that I'm with. You know what they did? They did like people around us did our whole life. They connected getting drunk with that evening. And me and you, the effect that was produced by alcohol, I connected to happiness that I'm going to be searching for the rest of my life. That happiness, man. Not that ha-ha happiness. That happiness inside you that makes you feel like this is how you're supposed to be feeling. And you know what? No longer am I going to ever have any goals necessary in my life. No longer am I going to have to wonder what my old man wants me to be when I grow up. No longer am I going to have to worry if I'm going to go into service or anything, if I'm going to have any goals or what I'm going to do if I graduate. Because the moment that I feel odd, insecure, restless, irritable, and discontented, I know that I can connect happiness with drinking. And I didn't head out to Skid Row after that, but I connected happiness every time, and that was 99.9% of the time I knew where I could find that comfort, that ease and comfort that comes with that drink. That ease and comfort that comes. Normal people need occasions to drink. Me and you need occasions to sober up. We're constantly, we have no thought process when it comes to drinking. Heaven forbid anybody that gets in the way of me and you and that next drink because we're going for it. We don't care how old they are. We don't care the promises we made. We don't care the love involved. We've got a job. We've got a destination. And it's that next drink. And we only feel like that when we're sober. And come time to get into high school, I don't have any peer groups. And everybody has a peer group at this time. And, I don't have a peer group, you know. And I start hanging around some of the surfers, and it seemed like all they did is whine around the weather and the waves, you know, and I got enough of that at home, you know. And come the summer after my freshman year, I found a group of people that made me feel more a part of life than the people did at Alcoholics Anonymous. I found a group of people that there was love, and there was camaraderie, and there was brotherhood, and there was unity, and it was the lowriders. And I love the lowriders. The first thing they appealed to me was their vanity and their insanity, man. I just love the lowriders, man. We used to get our hair up real high. You know, Bob used to talk about slicking his hair back. We came in another generation later, man. We hairsprayed ours up, baby. It looked like a damn tumbleweed. I'd get my hair up so big, you know, and we'd just drive around and drink that gin and listen and eat those reds. And we'd bounce around listening to the Four Tops and the Temptations and the OJs and Marvin Gaye and Smokey Robinson. God, I loved it, man. It wasn't but a couple weeks ago at work, I'm driving around my work truck, and I'm listening to the Four Tops, and I start sinking in my damn work truck. I loved the way I felt, man. I swear to God, I loved every moment of that, man. I got this little Mexican girlfriend named Lupi, you know, and she gets her hair up real high. She curls her hair up with these soup cans, and sometimes the soup and shit's still in her cans, you know, and she get her hair up real high, you know, and she get her sweater on and get her hair up real high and paint her eyebrows, you know, and I get my hair up real high, you know, and I get this white shirt and these black khaki pants with these pointed shoes and this hair like this that you could see at the corner before I turned it, man, you know. God damn, man, we'd drive around, you know, and we'd wonder what the hell you're looking at. What are you looking at, man, you know? See these people, you know, what the hell are you looking at, man? We'd spend all damn night in that car. We'd have about six people who we all looked alike. There was nothing but hairspray. I mean, you know, just hairspray and eyes. We'd just bounce around all damn night, man. And I loved it. I loved the way it made me feel, man. I couldn't wait till that one time it's in driver's education class. You're a sophomore, man. You got the biggest man in the world that's going to teach you how to drive, right? Like you ain't driven. All right? So this guy says, Thomas, it's your turn to get in the car. Get in the car. So I get my hair in the damn car like that, you know. Crush it down a little, you know, and I look in the rearview mirror and there's these three girls in the back seat, you know, and all I can see is hair and eyes back there, you know, and we're driving around and this coach seems to be thinking I'm doing all right. He says, man, you're doing all right. He says, I want you to pull into the Jack in the Box. I want to buy everybody some Pepsi. Well, what this guy doesn't know is that 15 minutes before class, I took four of what they then called Tylenols. These babies are great. I've just been doing heroin and Reds up to then and drinking that cheap gin. This guy lays me on a couple of these Tylenols and perfect alky. One? I don't think so. Four? Yeah. And I took four of those babies, man, and those things are hypnotic, man. I swear to God, you can be falling towards the curb. And everything coming at you, man, is slow motion, you know. It's just coming at you, and you go, well, here comes that damn curb. Yeah. You know, yeah, here it comes, going right at me, you know. Yeah, I'll move sometime, you know. You just get right in it, you know. Boom, you know. Well, I guess I'm on the curb now, you know. I guess I'll roll over here and hit, you know. And it, everything just, you know, comes to a screen. And you talk. You want these, you're talking, and it just takes on a whole different tone, you know. I mean, you're thinking you're saying, how you doing? And it sounds like, you know, people are looking, you know. And this guy says, man, you're driving real good. He says, pull into the Jack in the Box. I want to buy you all some Pepsis. Well, shit, I pull into this Jack in the Box and boom, these things nail me, man. I'm breaking out in a sweat. My ears are ringing, you know, and I can't see shit, man, you know. And all I can see is that puppet, and I can hear him saying, can I have your order, please? Well, baby, I'll just hone in for that, you know. And I'm driving around, and can I have your order, please? And I'm trying to aim for the menu, and I see that puppet box, and I just step on it, man. I'm going to go order, and I, bam, I run over the damn puppet, man. And I see this puppet head hanging down like that. And, can I have your order, please? You know, and I want to talk to him. You know, I want to ask him to come out and drive is what I want him to do, you know. And Jesus Christ, they come out and they arrest me, you know, and they throw me on the hood of the car. They shatter my hair all over the damn parking lot, you know. Hair's flying everywhere. It's like glass, you know. Pulling out Reds in my pocket, you know. These girls are crying. My coach is wondering what the hell's going on, you know. I don't drive till I'm 30, you know. Big deal, because now I'm at the time of my life, baby. I swear to God, because if there was two things I was ever made for alkies, it was alcohol and mirrors. We love those mirrors, man. There's something about mirrors that we just love. Getting in those bars, looking down that bar, all you see is alkies looking at alkies in the mirrors, man. Just ricocheting all night. You don't get up and talk to anybody. You can talk to him through the damn mirror, man. Go around the pickled pig feet. He's over there, you know. And I love those mirrors, man. I spent 2 hours this morning captured by my own magnificence, you know. Hope the flies don't land on my hair this morning. Shit, you know. I tell you, if a mosquito come and landed on my hair, he'd die, because he ain't getting out. Lowriders know how to spray their damn hair, man. I swear to God, I got so much Aquanet on here right now that, you know, and man, you know, and now I'm riding shotgun. I'm shotgun. I got it made. I'm calling the shots. I got some goof Raul driving over here, and I'm starting to eat those Reds, and guess what I get a hold of? I get a hold of that rearview mirror. Oh, my God, look at this fox. 110 pounds, he can't lick a stamp, man, you know. I get my tank top on, and I get all loaded on that gin. I'll press my arm down on the side of the car, make that son of a bitch look big, so you don't mess with me. God damn it, you know. And in my own mind, nobody ever knew this, I become Lawrence of Torrance. Not a soul knows this, man. Nobody knows this but me. I've got this own little image. I've got these three clowns that look just like me, you know, and we're running around, and man, I loved every minute of it. Every ounce of dope I was doing, every shot of gin was working, man, and you could not tell me that my alcoholic life was not the normal one. How else are you going to find a life this happy? Happy is normal. This is the happiest thing I ever knew, man, because in my own mind, I became somebody. I'm no longer Betty and Bob's little boy. I'm no longer that kid next door, man. In my own mind, I'm somebody. My sponsor says I'm an almost. I've always been a nothing, he says. He says, now you're an almost, you're a lowrider. Hey, to nothing, that's top of the world. That's all you need, man. I knew me and Loopy and Pooch were going to ride off into the sunset all night long, man. I found life in that Chevy. I found it there. You couldn't tell me. Now, every answer to life was in that back seat. I knew it. And we'd drive all night, man, with that answer. And I loved every minute of it, man. And I tell you, if it still worked, I'd be bouncing around right now. I'd be bouncing around right now. It works so damn good. And come 1969, people are going places, man. Some of my buddies are going to Wayside. Some of them are going to Vietnam. Some of them are going to Chino. Some are returning hippie and going to Big Sur. And I don't know what to do with my life. So I go to Phoenix. Brilliant move, Larry. You know, I mean, the women beat you up over there if you look like a lowrider, you know. I mean, they're just hideous, man. And here comes this old blonde lowrider into Phoenix. And there's nothing but, you know, kind of a Bakersfield-ish kind of town there, you know. It's just Ponderosa feeling, you know. And And I'm up on North Central Avenue at the Apache Motel, where else, you know, and there's the old wagon wheel bar down across the street. And I don't know about you, but something's happening in my life right now. My drinking's starting to take on some weird little phases here. And one of them is that I start becoming whoever I'm around in a matter of two Boilermakers. I can be sitting at the wagon wheel bar, and I'm sitting next to this guy, and we're taking our shots at Boilermakers. Me, he says, "Hi, how are you doing?" I said, "I'm doing fine. How are you?" You know, I said, "The hell is that coming from?" You know, and I'll take the old Greyhound bus back to Gardena, and I'll be sitting at an old Japanese bar and having my Boilermaker, and there'll be a fella go, "Hi, how are you doing?" "I'm doing pretty good. How are you?" You know, I don't know who in the hell I am, for Christ's sake. You know, I don't know what's going on here. What the hell's going on? I can't figure it out for the life of me, man. You know, and Jesus, and you put that on all night just to keep those drinks coming, you know. I put on a damn kimono if I had to for the son of a bitch, you know. Keep it going, you know. Maybe I am Japanese. I don't know. I don't know, for Christ's sake. Can I get some more, Joe? Is there a coffee? Can I get a shot of coffee? You're new. You're not doing nothing. Here. Take this, Mr. Speaker. You know, I've had done worse, so. I don't know what the hell's going on here, you know, but, I don't got a craft or anything like that. He's got to be related to you, huh? Okay, so. Oh, that Joe's good here. The Joe's good here. And the help down here. Oh. And so, man, here I am in Phoenix, lost again. And I don't got a job or anything like that, so I start selling people to pay for my habit. Then I become a doctor. I start writing prescriptions for Seconal and Tuinol and Nembutal and Obitrol. You name it all. I damn near wrote it all, man. Writing these scripts all over Phoenix, you know, and they cut up with me, and they put me away for 2 years in an institution over in Arizona. And in 1972, I'm 21 years old, and the thing that stands me here tonight is starting to happen. And if you're new, you'll hear it in several different ways. And it may confuse you, and this is how I perceived it when I was new. Is I would hear two sets of people, and they sound something like this. I had a life, I started drinking, it got bad, and I come to AA and everything's wonderful. And then there's another herd. I had a life, I started drinking, it got bad, it stopped working. Hey, then I come to AA. Well, at the age of 21, it stopped working. I did not come to AA. That was not my first thought. Oh, wow. You know, time to go to A&A. No. I did what I assume alcoholics of my type, they tell me, do. Now I'm obsessed to find a drunk I no longer can find. That drunk I used to get with a half a pint. That drunk that came with ease and comfort. You didn't have to search. You didn't have to combine anything. It was there. I can't find it. I can't find that drunk. I can't find it, man. And now I'm concerned about my drinking. Not to sober up. Now I'm real concerned because that drunk, I can't find it no more. And now I'm panic ridden. Now I know terror. Because that thing that I used to count on, that thing that made me like you, is no longer there. And now I'm on that frantic search, and if I get the right combination of things, I can find it again. Maybe it's some heroin and some whiskey. Maybe it's some cocaine and some vodka. Maybe it's some red and some Old English. I know if I get the right combination of things, I can get it to work again. Why? Because in 1967, in the back of a Chevy, it worked once. It's got to work again. Because at the age of 12 years old, I connected a happiness that I knew I would never disconnect, and I've got to find it again. And I only think about that when I'm sober. I only think about that when I'm sober. The way that I felt when I was sober drove me to drink. And I can't find it, man. And I got a frantic life of trying to find a drunk. And sometimes you're almost there. Sometimes you're one drink away. Just one more. Oh, yeah, man, I'm getting it again. This is it. And you have that one more shot. And in 3 days, you wake up and go, "What the hell happened? I didn't want to do this, man. What the hell happened to my job?" And you get together your last two checks, and you get your stuff at the Goodwill, and you check into a motel, and my life's a series of fresh starts, my inventory says. I love starting over. There's a certain anxiousness about that. There's a certain apprehension about this time it'll be it. I'll get it all, I'll get all my ducks in a row, and I'll get that job, and she's okay, and yeah, this is it. Boy, if there's anything that's a killer to an alky, it's good fortune. because we start building ourselves up on it. Now, things are, maybe I've been taking this thing a little too heavy, you know. Look at it, I've got a job for 2 weeks. I mean, really, maybe I'm jumping to conclusions here. I mean, you know, I've been hammered by a lot of people here lately about my drinking, you know, and they don't know, you know, and by golly, I tell you, all it takes is for me to get physically healthy. I used to think that was it. I used to think that if I could stay sober enough and detox enough and get that old stuff out of my system, that I'd be able to have a good drunk again. Maybe it'll take a month. I can handle that. I can do a month on my own. You see, get that old stuff out, that old whiskey, you know, that old Santa Fe port. Get it out, get it out, get it out. Get it out of there, man. Just make room some good scotch, you know. Get it out, you know. It's a bad hooch, you know. And just, you know, it's just crazy. The idea of not drinking has never entered my mind. No matter how great the necessity nor the wish, the book says, the idea of not drinking does not enter our mind. I get sober and I start picking apart my last drunk. I start thinking how I'm going to do it in a different place with different people, maybe not leave the room at all. I never think about not drinking. I think about changing every other thing, but not drinking. No, no, we'll get that in there. See? We'll get that in there. Physically beat. Physically torn up, liver out to here. My feet are as fat as a football. My body saying no, and my body and my mind saying yes. My body saying no more, my mind saying one more. That conflict of the alcoholic. And how the hell are you going to explain that to anybody? How you doing? You know? You know? That's why I hated that when I was new. People would ask me, how you doing today? You know, I tell you, son of a bitch, you know, how the hell you explain that? How am I doing, you bastard, you know? Been setting up your meeting for a week. I'm crazy, you know. I'm absolutely, there's a two-sided sword here. I mean, it looks good, you know. Spiritual experience, you'll get sober. Let me tell you something. Go ahead and work those steps. Get that spiritual experience. Have that obsession to drink removed. And if you're like me, now what do I do? You know, I've people get sober here and they have a spiritual experience and they get restored and return to normal living. I wouldn't know normal living if it hit me in the knee. So what am I to return to? I've had the obsession of drink removed and now I've got this, ooh, wow. We're talking fear. We got some fear going here. I'm getting thirsty. Maybe I did it too quick. He's a pushy sponsor, man. He's always hammering me, you know. And I tell you, man, in 1974, my probation officer had it about up to here. He's tried the anabuse and he's tried this therapy. He's tried all this stuff they were doing back then. So he sends me to Camarillo for 2 months to be observed. Then 4 months go by and then 8 months go by. 13 months later, I come out of Camarillo with every reason why I should drink. They told me I'd be better off if I did. They said people like me and you don't operate out in society without some type of... I lasted 2 months out there and I ran out of Thorazine. And I'm picked up in Los Angeles on 5th, going wild out there, being drunk, disorderly, public nuisance, violation of probation, and they stick me away in Wayside again. And in 1975, I came out of Wayside. I'm in a holding tank over there in Torrance at the South Bay Courthouse. And they're transferring guys to different jails. It was a transfer jail then. And I hear them saying they're transferring guys to Tehachapi. Load up. They're transferring guys to Chino. Load up. They're transferring guys to Wayside. Load up. Thomas, you're going to AA. Load up. What the hell's AA land, you know? I figure there's another trip across the desert, you know, some AA land. And a Scottish man with a patch came over to the jail cell. And he says, "Aye, lad." He says, "My name is Alex." He says, "Are you Larry Thomas?" And I said, "Yeah." He says, "Come on with me, son." He says, "You're going to AA." And I look around me and I'm not chained to anybody. I look around me and there's not a black and white car. There's a lime green Plymouth. And Alex takes me to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous in 1975. He takes me 6 blocks away. I said, "What the hell is this?" Guys, pulls me into this big little club over there in downtown Torrance called the Torrance Lamita Alano Club. Alano Club? What the hell is this? A Samoan bar? What's an Alano Club, you know? You know, where do they come up with these words here? You know, some kind of Polynesian party going on, you know? Maybe it's like a Samoan Elks Club. I don't know what the hell it is. In 1975, he takes me into this Alano Club. He introduces me to a lady named Indian Jeannie, and
Captain Bob and Tennessee Bill and Singing Sam and Serenity Sam and Bicycle Ray and Santa Claus Ray and a little lady named Moose. I said, what in the hell am I doing here, for Christ's sake, you know? I just left a group of people like this, you know? Everybody got a nickname and a tattoo, you know? The goal for today is get a cup on that damn wall, you know? Come on now, let's get a life here, you know? Moose come running up to me and she goes, hi, my name is Moose. I'm expecting a miracle. I said, I bet you are, Moose. I bet you are. No doubt in my mind, man. I'm not it, you know. And then this big transvestite comes sneaking up on me, you know, and said, move, Peaches. No. This big transvestite comes swooping up on me and just, hey, like that. And she, I can't wait to take you to candlelight meetings. I says, I don't think so. Yeah. No. Not for the first year anyway, you know. You know, I've got some principles. I may be a drunk, you know. Give me a year, we'll think about it. And I like your earrings, I said, some shit like that. And so, man, I took a look around that room and I said, my God, if that's Alcoholics Anonymous, I must not be one. Ooh-wee. Ooh-wee, baby. You know, and if that's the effect of this Doring blue book, I'm not sure I want to dabble in this mess right yet, you know. And I was immediately different. Boom. That's it. And from 1975 to 1982, I came in and out of Alcoholics Anonymous on a regular basis. 30 days and get drunk, 60 days and get drunk, 90 days and get drunk. And the longest I could stay sober was 6 months because I was on heroin again. And I wonder why I wasn't having a spiritual experience. That is not coming in and out of AA. Let's clear up some garbage here. That is not coming in and out of AA. I hear that thrown around a lot. What you're doing is going in and out of meeting halls. Big deal. They got a janitor does the same thing, you know. Big deal. There's an illusion that we think that these rooms for an hour and a half is AA. This is a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. If sitting in rooms for an hour and a half would cure your disease, this place would be packed. That's why the faces change every year. There's a new herd. Boom. Because they start seeking another answer. This must not be enough. I'm different. Sitting in rooms for an hour and a half is not the answer. It's part of a great big answer. And I would go in and out of these rooms, and every time I'd come back, I'd be different, I'd be desperate, and I'd be at that point where I think I wanted to get sober. Every time I come back, and every time I come back, I was a little bit different. You were richer then. I was poorer then. You're older then. I'm younger then. Always something to keep me different. You see, I thought that feeling different meant that I wasn't an alcoholic. And what it is a symptom of your disease. If you're new and you're feeling different, welcome. If you're new and you've got one day sober and you feel great, you may not need us. You may not need us, but if you're in here and you're new and you're fairly new or fairly old and you're feeling differences, Alcoholics Anonymous will put you around some other people that feel different, where you won't have to feel alone so much. And together, you can round off the edges of differences. Feeling different is a symptom of your disease. And welcome to a room of differences. I love Alcoholics Anonymous. I love it so much. I fought that tooth and nail. And in 1980, I've got people in my life that are doing their 12-step. I've always been, people in AA have always been there when I called, man. They've always been there. Thank God for our central offices. Thank God for these people in service who pick up these phones and talk to drunk like me, man, because there's a guy in my life named Don, and this guy's there every time, man. I'm calling him up, and he's there, and I'm at the Don Hotel over there in Wilmington off of Avalon and Broad, and I'm on the second floor, man, and I've got the two most important things in my life. I got a hot plate and a hot TV. I got a PM bourbon bottle cut in half. It's about 10 in the morning, and it's a Tuesday morning, man. I'm starting to chug-a-lug on my little lawn chair, you know, and getting ready what my plans are today, you know, and I hear this... I said, my God, it's 10 in the morning. Who in the hell is that? Did the landlord call somebody or something, you know? Larry, it's Don. Oh, shit, it's a guy from AA. I didn't even call him and he's coming over, man, you know? He said, can I come in? I said, yeah. And he opens up the door. He says, oh, man. What are you doing? What are you doing, man? You had 15 days, Larry. You had 15 days. You're going to be a janitor with the city of Lamita. There's some hope for you new guys. So you can be a janitor when you get here, you know. And he had this new guy with him, Herbie. Herbie's got one day
he's all shiny, man. He's just, you know, he's looking at me and he's going, ain't a care in the world here, you know. I mean, Herbie's feeling great, you know. Got one day sober with his sponsor and stuff like that, man. Don says, man, what are you doing, Larry? What the hell are you doing, man? You know, and I'm wondering, God, he's bringing company and you don't even ask me, you know. What the hell's going on here? I got one hot plate. I'm not cooking for everybody, you know. He says, what the hell's going on? And I started feeling sorry for the guy. God, this guy's trying real hard, you know, this poor son of a bitch, you know. And I'm thinking he's coming to see me because I'm alcoholic. He's coming to see me because he's alcoholic. He don't care if I stay sober or not. His job is to carry the message to the alcoholic. What I do with the message ain't none of his business. He's happy in a pig in a barn when he sees me, man. And I said, Don, I said, you've been trying real hard. Man, you've been trying real hard. I says, I don't want what you have. I don't want what you got. And if I ever get that bad, I'll know where to go. Just get the hell out of my room and let me do what I want to do. And I took a shot of that bourbon, man, right in front of him. Just let me do what I want to do. I remember barking at him. And the moment that I said that, it struck a chord in the back of my neck that shut me down in 1967, man. Me and my old man are wrestling around in the garage. He kicked me out of the house because I'm selling dope at high school at the age of 15, 16. He's saying, get out of this house, kid. I don't want to see this around my daughters. I said, I'm beating up my old man, and me and my old man are fighting again. I'm loaded up on that gin and some reds, and I'm saying, you can't kick me out of my house. I'm your son. Just get up off my back and let me do what I want to do. I didn't ask to be born. My drinking ain't bothering nobody. Well, what if I'm selling dope at high school? That's my life. What the hell are you going to tell me what to do? Look at you. You're stuck in a window half your life, you know? What the hell, you know? Let me do what I want to do. It reminds me of 1972 when I'm coming out of that joint in Arizona. And where do macho men go where there's no place to go? We go to Mom's house. Happy Mother's Day. I'm over at Mom's house. I wake up at 3 in the morning and I can't find my old Pro bottle. And I start searching for it. I know she poured it out, that son of a bitch. I know she poured it out. And I start wrestling around and I can't find it. Make enough noise for Mom to come down the hallway. She says, honey, what's wrong? I says, don't you, honey, what's wrong? You know what's wrong. You poured out my whiskey. And I start smacking around my mom, demanding that she goes to the store and go gets me some. Demanding that she goes and gets me some more whiskey. As I pass out after taking enough stuff in the cupboards and stuff like that to wake up in the morning to look in the trash to see that I drank it all. I put the empty in the trash. Let me do what I want to do. Reminds me of the countless times I'm in Alcoholics Anonymous and I'm waking up in a park one afternoon. And I hear the sound of little kids' voices. And I hear their teachers say, watch over the sick man, step around him. And I wake up and I've got sober eyes. And I see all these little kids walking by me. They're on a field trip. And they're all looking down at me. Some of them are pointing. Some of them are laughing. Some of them see their old man in me. I don't know. But I see their clear little faces. And I feel that disgust and that hideous remorse of the alcoholic. God, this can't be me. Let me do what I want to do. It reminds me of my best friend in Phoenix, Arizona, where I'm stone cold sober. He's drowning and he's 10 feet away. And the only thought that I have is when he's gone, I get his dope. Let me do what I want to do is why I'm in Alcoholics Anonymous right now. Me doing what I want to do for as long as I can stand it. Nobody going to tell me what to do. Nobody going to tell me what to do. Nobody's going to take away my right to drink. Who are you to take away my right to drink? I would shout at Don. And then you folks have politely told me, we haven't taken away your right to drink. And you encourage me to go get it if I don't like it here. You will gladly refund my misery. Here, you don't like it here in AA? Go find a better way. We haven't found one, but if you've got an idea, go for it. My sponsor tells me, you don't like it here, jackass? Go out there and find another way. And all that went through my head is the only answer to life I've ever had in my life leaves my room in Wilmington. The only answer to life, and from 1980 to 1982, I'm stuck with the memory of the faces of Alcoholics Anonymous. And if you're new and you're having trouble staying, you may leave us, but we'll never leave you. We'll never leave you. Because somehow, someday, when you least expect it, you're going to be curled up in that alley in Wilmington or in Santa Barbara, and you've been panhandling all day for that bottle of Muscatel, and you're going to cap the seal, and you go, yeah. And you're going to think about that jackass with the tie on Sunday in Santa Barbara. Or you're going to think about Tim, or you're going to think about Miles, or you're going to think about Butch, or you're going to think about Gloria, you're going to think about somebody good or bad in Alcoholics Anonymous, because the seed's been planted. And if you're not alcoholic, don't worry about it. It's only planted in Alkies. It's only planted in Alkies. And he planted that seed of Alcoholics Anonymous in me. And for 2 years, I'm in that hideous part of our life where we can't get drunk, we can't get sober, we can't live, we can't die, and we think we've been to AA. And you've got enough self-pity to keep you on the streets, self-supporting by the government and the state, and you mission hop and you do these little things to be right about your condition. You see, because it's not your fault. God damn it, it's everybody's around you. But my God, it's not your fault. You know nothing about a fourth column inventory, believe me. It's all their fault, and this is what damn him too. Look what this is. What the hideous trick is this? To have me be born and then to kill me like this? And you want me to rely on you and ask you for help? This is the help I get. Screw you too. And for 2 years I'm like that, and I'm stuck with the memory of that mind, the memory of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I couldn't get you out of my mind. And on May 1st, I'm down there in Wilmington. I'm at the Beacon Light Mission. I'm going by this Woolworth store. And as you see, for 2 years, I'm doing my best not to see myself in mirrors and reflections of car windows and stuff like that. Because there's that moment that you... And I would take the showers in these hotels and in these missions, and I'd open up the medicine chest so I don't got to see my face in that mirror, so I don't have to catch eyes with the man who's killing himself. The man who has no hope, that sick weakling, that man that... It's just so disgusting and needs so much help and who's just lost. I was so afraid to connect eyes with that. I'd keep that mirror open. I wouldn't look at myself in reflections. I didn't want to see what I'd become. I didn't want to take responsibility for my own actions. And on May 2nd, 1982, I gave up enough dough and I did what I always did when I get that moment. I called Alcoholics Anonymous. And who do I get? I get Don. Don, this is Larry. I'm ready to come back to Alcoholics Anonymous. Will you come and get me? That old man told me the most profound thing I've ever heard in my life. He said, "No, you little son of a bitch." He said, "You know where we are. You know what we got. If you want to get sober, you get your rusty ass down here yourself. I'm tired of chasing after you." He says, "That sign says we care. It doesn't say we're going to take care of you." And he hung up. I said, "What the hell is this? That guy used to be so nice, man. That guy used to be so nice. What the hell's gotten under his drawers, you know?" And that day, I took the longest walk of my life, the shortest distance. I walked 12 miles to Wilmington to Torrance, to that same little dingy club on a Thursday. I got there at 10 in the morning, and I shook it out with you, and I threw up with you, and I hallucinated with you, and I got wild with you. And I stood up at the Thursday night meeting and I said, "My name is Larry Thomas, I'm an alcoholic." And for the first time in my life, I felt like a member. For the first time in my life, I was there to stay sober. Because there was one thing I couldn't deny. That while I was coming in and out of these meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, you were staying sober. Regardless of what you looked like, regardless of your little nicknames, there was one thing I couldn't deny. You were staying sober. And I just prayed to God I could work these steps and not look like you. Give me that, okay? And now I blend right in. And boy, after that meeting, man, I'm thinking, well, God damn it, man, you know, maybe Don will invite me into his house. Maybe I want to go to that mission, you know? He's my sponsor, you know? He took me home after the meeting. He set me in that... He had a little abandoned Toyota in the back of his backyard in Lameda. He says, "You stay in that damn Toyota all night and shake it out." He says, "You stay in there." And he slammed the door. And then he come back and he says, "And another thing." He says, "You better find a God, you little son of a bitch." And he slammed the door again. I said, "This guy's going wild, man. This is absolutely nuts, you know." And I've been there for about 15 minutes and I'm going, "I got to find a God? How am I going to find a God in here?" I start looking in the glove compartment and shit, you know. You know, looking for a little pamphlet, you know. And I'm, "God, I got to find a God. I got to find a God, you know." And around 3 in the morning... And I'm just hallucinating like mad. Every car that goes by, you know, I'm hearing things, you know, "Larry, Larry," you know, shit like that. And trees are breathing. I'm hearing people whisper out, you know, the usual stuff, you know. And about 3 in the morning, I'm looking out this old stinky Toyota, you know, and I'm saying, I'm looking at these trees and they're breathing, you know. I'm going, "You know what? This will be the last time I ever have to do this. I don't know if I got another drunk in me. Who knows? I don't know. I know one thing. I don't ever want to be new again. I don't ever want to have one day again. I don't ever want to be a newcomer. I don't ever want to have 5 days. I don't ever want to stand up, get these silly ass chips. I don't ever want to stand up and be new. I will do anything not to be new. Anything. I hate new. Newcomers are grief. I hate it. I don't want to be new. Anything to keep Don, whatever you say, you know, whip me silly. I don't want to be new, man. And I love that feeling, man. I don't got to go through this again. And then the son of a bitch, I'm thinking that morning he's going to take me in his house. And said, no, he took me right back down to the damn mission. He says, there, meet me at 6 in the morning. We're going to go to work. I said, oh, wait a minute. You know, now we're talking work. You know, I just want to get sober, you know. And for 3 months I stayed at that mission. And I walked there and I'd go back at night and sing for my beans and have them come down and save me and stuff like that. And then I'd go back to my Alcoholics Anonymous meetings and he'd put me to work and stuff like that. And for my first 2 years, I was stone crazy. Stone crazy. Just wild. You see, because I've always been a man of images. I've always had something to hide behind. Little lowrider, little loser. And now the thing that I'm hiding behind is I'm a slipper. My case is different. You don't quite understand. I need a slipper sponsor. I need a slipper book. I need slipper meetings. I need a pair of slippers, for Christ's sake. Send me home, you know. And I become the worst image that I've ever come behind, because it takes about a year and a half to become a club guru. Where, you know, I think that's about the nature of the run there. You know, you got some decals on your car, you know, a couple phrases, you know, a couple girls, you know where the dances are, surely, you know. And for an hour and a half, you're wonderful. Half hour before meeting time, you put your AA face on. You come down to the meeting hall and you shake hands and pour coffee and forget names. Half hour after meeting time, you go home and die. And you spend your waking moments trying desperately to work an honest program dishonestly. And Alcoholics Anonymous is gonna cut you off from the nearest and dearest thing you've ever had, and it's called your old lifestyle. Because in moments of desperation, when you're new, you return to it every time. Why? Because you're sure of it. It's the surest thing you got, it's the stinking way you live. And you try to hide it when you come into your meetings. And you throw it off by being happy, joyous, and free. And when you haven't worked any steps and when you're new, you talk a lot about God. Newcomers know a lot about God. They can describe Him. He's got a personality. He's got a hat tilted this way. They know about God. What they don't know is about a spiritual way of life. And for a year and a half, I was crazy. And at about 2 years sober, a man came down to my meeting. And he said, there's a triangle in Alcoholics Anonymous, Larry. It's called Unity, Service, and Recovery. He says, but there's another triangle. It's called Homework and Play. He says, what do you like when you leave here? What do you like when you go home? And if you're new, I guarantee you that what I do in between meetings is going to constitute whether I stay sober or not. What I do when I'm away from you, in between meetings, how am I conducting myself in between meetings? I can be great for an hour and a half when people are watching. I can be well-mannered. How you do? I can just be great. Well, what am I like at home? What am I like at work? What am I like in that neighborhood? And that man taught me about that. And I had to follow that man because he talked about a way of life. And he took me to a home group. My sponsor's name is Johnny. My home group is the Big Book Group of Bellflower. And I'm sober today not because of who they are, but because of what they've introduced me to. They've introduced me to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous in its entirety. In its entirety. The man that talked last night. I had not a clue what to do with my life. And I went to Bob. I went to Bob Decker when I was new in that group. I said, I don't know what the hell to do with my life. I don't have a craft. I don't know what to do. How am I going to make a job? He says, man, he says, do you ever remember doing anything, any type of little job? He says, what did you do in jail? I said, well, I remember you were a baker. He says, well, what did you do when you were in there over there for a while? I said, well, I was a duty plumber. You know, on emergencies, they'd pull me out and we'd work on it. He says, man, he says, they're making it. Why don't you try plumbing? No shit. He says, yeah. And Alcoholics Anonymous has made me a plumber. They dragged me out of the gutters and stuck me in the sewer, for Christ's sake. You know? And they talked to me about making these amends and practicing these principles on all of our affairs. And on a morning like this, I think about people in that group. I think about these instrumental people in my life that have been put in my life. And on a morning like this, I like to think about a dear friend of mine called Mac Baker. I like to think about my friend called Mac because he introduced me to the kitchen. I'm a coffee maker. I ain't no big deal in Alcoholics Anonymous. I hope that's the highest I ever get is coffee maker. I'm a coffee maker and a cookie lady. And Mac introduced me to that kitchen, and he taught me about having respect for little things like being a coffee maker. Treat it with respect, Larry. Get here early. Clean up those coffee pots. Watch the room fill while you're the first one in the room, and watch the people fill the room. Watch the laughter. Hear the laughter. Hear the joy. Feel the love of Alcoholics Anonymous. One by one, as the people come and they fill your rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, watch them. And he taught me how to watch you like a hawk. And he says, if you can respect that little nickel and dime job as a coffee maker, then maybe you can respect the man that's called your sponsor. And he says, if you can respect those, he says, maybe you can respect somebody who needs all the respect in the world from you. And that's the lady of your life. I love my little Gloria. He taught me how to respect her. It wasn't but a couple months ago, I'm at a meeting over there in San Diego, and me and this newcomer are sitting in. And this lady comes walking by me, and this newcomer edges me on the arm, and he says, hey, Sponce, how would you like somebody like that on your arm? And I told that newcomer, I says, let me tell you something. I've had hundreds of people on my arm, but I've only had one person in my heart. And once you've had somebody in your heart, you do not jeopardize that. You don't put it in jeopardy. You don't test it. And Alcoholics Anonymous has been in my heart. Gloria has been in my heart. You've been in my heart. I don't place my sobriety in jeopardy. You see, what you've given me is a gift from God, and what I give back is my gift back to my Father. You gave me the keys to the kingdom, as Gloria said. And you've taught me a little thing about making amends. It says if we are painstaking through a certain phase of our development, we're going to start doing and feeling certain things. They're assuming you're in your ninth step. They're assuming you're halfway through your ninth step, not on the verge of your ninth day. Everything about Alcoholics Anonymous comes after a fact. You see, I don't like that. I'm a something-for-nothing guy. Give me it first. Give me the dope. I'll pay you tomorrow. Give me that fifth. I'll pay you in 2 days. Give me the job. Don't hold back my first week. I want cash every day. I come into Alcoholics Anonymous, and I wanted you to front me AA. Yeah, you know, give me all the goodies. Yeah, give me my 10 years. Give me that serenity. Give me all the peace and comfort and joy. I swear to God, I'll work the steps next week. I swear to God, I'll start writing. Alcoholics Anonymous doesn't like that. It deals with takers of life. The derelicts of the world are in these rooms. We know nothing about life. We are undisciplined, the book says. And you taught me about taking the actions, and the results will come later. Results will come later. Trust God and clean house. You know? And I remember making amends, man. And I remember, you know, so many people these days are worried about paying off their dope dealers. You've got some people in your life that deserve an amends, and they're called your mother and father and the children that are around you. They're called family. These are the people that watched you tear your life apart. These are the people that worried about you and that cared about you and that wanted nothing but the best from you. These are the people that we go back to. This is that family afterwards. There's a lot better people, more deserving for your amends than some dope dealer. Deal with that immediate circle first. And my sponsor taught me about that. And then there was an amends that I had to make. When I was 14, my best friend, my righteous partner, he went away on vacation. Jeff was my righteous partner, man. Me and him lowrided together for years. And while he went on vacation, I robbed his house and took his dad's prize coin collection, and I hawked it down at the pawn shop, got the money, and sold Jeff some Reds. My best friend. That's the kind of nickel and dime crap I do. And I'm about 7 years sober, and I'm going through this elevator over at Montgomery Ward, and here comes old Jeff down the escalator. All right, Jeff, how you doing? How you doing? Bing, there's his old man. God, I started talking with Jeff. I said, hey, is your dad still around? Is your dad? Because he was on my list. He was in my inventory, man, that little nickel and dime thing I couldn't stuff down. And he said, yeah, he's over there on Red Beam. Took my little $20 check. I slowly drove over there, and the garage door is open, man. And I look over in the garage, and there's this old man. And I talked it over with my sponsor, and I go walking up that driveway, and I hear this. I says, oh, wow, what the hell is that? His old man was a deer hunter. He's packing shotgun shells. He's going hunting. And I walk into that garage, and I hear this.
I said, Mr. Mathlin? He said, yeah. My name is Larry Thomas. Yeah? Well, back in 1965, me and you, you know, and I said, I stole your coin collection, and I said, I'd like to make amends. And I hear this. He says, look at you, little son of a bitch. I want to tell you something about that coin collection. He says, when my father died, that was the only thing he ever left to me, was that coin collection. And you took it and you pawned it. That was the only thing left that I have of my father's memory. He says, now give me your little silly ass check, and if I ever see your feet on my property again, I'll blow your head off. He says, I don't care if you're walking hand in hand with Jesus Christ. You tore my heart up. Now get out of here. These are the people that I had to deal with. People were not welcoming me back in their lives. They weren't glad that I was sober, most of them. These are the people that I had to confront. These are the people that are on our list. And at the age of, it wasn't but about 5 years, I guess it was about 1987, 1989, I'm in a relationship and I'm living a lie. I'm living with a lady that I don't love because my pride's telling me, what'll people think? I'm living in a relationship that I can't get out of because maybe it'll get better in a week. Maybe it'll get better with this. Anything but change. And we have a baby daughter. And at a year and a half, my baby daughter's in a hallway, and I'm in a hallway, and me and her mother are starting to shove each other around. We're starting to get loud and violent. And I go to shove that lady, and I look down, and I see my daughter's eyes. I see my baby Lauren's eyes looking up at me. And I catch eyes with those brown eyes, and I see my eyes looking at my dad beating up my mom. And I said, not here. This isn't going to happen here. She is not going to witness this. She is not going to witness this kind of stuff in her life. And I got out of that relationship, and I bet my life that you are right. That I would hold up my responsibilities to her mother's monetarily and pay that child support. And that I would see that little girl 2 or 3 times a month and hope that she would still love me. I may not be her mother's husband anymore, but I'll always be her father. And I see that little girl on a regular basis. And she's 5 years old now. And we have her in our life. And she loves my little Gloria, and they love each other. And I come and get her, and she says, Papa, I love you. I love you, Papa. She hasn't forgotten. She sees Alcoholics Anonymous. Me and my baby Lauren are riding a bike down by the beach. We live down by the beach, and I've got my baby Lauren on a beach cruiser. And she's on the handlebars, and I spend a lot of alone time with her. And we're riding down the beach. She says, Papa, I love being with you here. I love this. I said, so do I, honey. I love this so much. I says, you know what I think about when I'm with you at the beach? She goes, no, Daddy, what? I go, I think about God. She goes, I think about you, Daddy. How the child can put it in perspective. And then it's not more than 2 months ago, me and my father are coming out of a restaurant for no reason at all. No reason at all. We just had lunch together. And as we're walking out of that restaurant, I feel an arm around my shoulder. And he shakes me and he says, I love you, kid. I love you. I've waited 40 years for that man to say that. 40 years. He may only say it once, but I heard it because I was sober and Alcoholics Anonymous. All my life I wanted that man to tell me he loved me, and he finally did. And I never would have heard it if I didn't come to Alcoholics Anonymous. And the life I live today has been worth every effort. The love that I have for you, the love that I have for my little Gloria, I love you so much that I will never put you in jeopardy. And I will treasure you. She has been so good to me. We met a couple years ago at a roundup. And the first thing I asked her was how long she was sober. And I asked her if she wanted a drink. And I come back with a Diet Coke and some diced up fruit. And I asked her if I could feed her fruit. And she's been eating every day. And I love my way of life. You know, when I was new in Alcoholics Anonymous, I used to think that Alcoholics Anonymous would shield me from life's little bullets. And what it does, it sticks you smack dab in the middle of life, and you better have a program because they don't care. They don't care how many chips you have, how many cakes you're taking, how many people you sponsor. You care. And that is exactly where I put my energy, in these rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. If you're new, I wish you desperation. I hope you're so desperate that you do things you don't even believe will work for you, and may God be with you. More important than that, I hope you do what we do here in Alcoholics Anonymous and find the God that I've found right here with the people. It's hard for me to not think about you without thinking about my God, and when I think about my God, it's hard for me not to think about you. If you're new, I welcome you, and I've had a tremendous time this weekend, and thank you very much.